October 4, 1957. From somewhere in the vastness of the Soviet Union, a strange metal sphere was hurled into orbit around the Earth. Its persistent beeps were like the shattering crack of a starter's gun. Its name was Sputnik. The race was on.
40 seconds and counting. The vehicle, all stages pressurized at this time.
I think that the United States has committed itself to this great adventure in the 60s. I think before the end of the 60s, we will see a man to the moon, an American. And I think in so doing, it's not merely that we're interested in making this particular journey, but we are interested in demonstrating a dominance of this new sea and making sure that in this new great adventure, Americans are playing their great role as they have in the past.
3, 2, all engines running. Launch commit, liftoff.
But long before Sputnik, a special breed of men had a dream. Goddard Ziolkovsky and Wernher von Braun. They foresaw the development of a powerful rocket which one day would carry men to the moon and beyond. When World War II ended, von Braun left Germany and came to the United States, where he worked under the aegis of the Army. In the closing days of the Eisenhower administration, spurred by Sputnik, we took our first baby steps into the age of space. Here's President Eisenhower.
The team that has had more experience in this field than any other is that headed by Dr. von Braun, a very brilliant group of scientists and which was brought together by the foresight and the wisdom of the Army in the original sense. They have done largely the work that they wanted to do for the Army. The Pershing, one or two other small items in which they have been working has been largely completed. They are the ones now that we're looking for to get and develop this big booster.
Our early steps were hesitant. Von Braun's team launched the first American unmanned satellite shortly after Sputnik, but the Soviets dramatically increased their lead.
Говорит Москва, Юрия Алексеевича Гагарина, спутника, Восток.
Radio Moscow announcing the first ever launch of a man in space. As Yuri Gagarin circled the Earth, our scientists were working hard to narrow the Soviet lead. An Air Force spokesman described one American milestone.
The Air Force recovered an object from orbit. This was the first such recovery in history. It actually occurred on the 13th Discoverer flight, and it was our seventh recovery attempt. It undoubtedly has been the most difficult satellite program undertaken thus far in this country.
We continued to lag behind the Russians, and Moscow, of course, made full use of its propaganda advantage. Yuri Gagarin in Britain.
He's a jolly good fellow, he's a jolly good fellow, and so they all
are. Вкладываете вы в свои награды, преподнесенные мне.
I am deeply moved, and I cannot express this in words, by these tokens of appreciation which you have showered upon me. Tokens of appreciation of my work, and also tokens of appreciation of the work of the entire Soviet people.
Throughout the 60s, an occasional voice was raised to call for East-West cooperation in the field of space. John Kennedy's was one at the United Nations.
Space offers no problems of sovereignty. By resolution of this assembly, the members of the United Nations have forsworn any claim to territorial rights in outer space or on celestial bodies and declared that international law and the United Nations Charter will apply. Why, therefore, should man's first flight to the moon be a matter of national competition? Why should the United States and the Soviet Union, in preparing for such expeditions, become involved in immense duplications of research, construction, and expenditure? Surely we should explore whether the scientists and astronauts of our two countries, indeed of all the world, cannot work together in the conquest of space.
The hand of friendship was extended, but the Soviets, as suspicious of us as we were of them, rejected it. So the two superpowers pursued their space program separately. And in May of 1961, the recently defeated presidential candidate, Richard Nixon, was able to say,
I am particularly proud that on the day I appeared, we have just had the announcement of the first successful manned flight in space, the astronaut flight from the United States.
Alan Shepard had spent 15 minutes in a suborbital ride aboard Freedom 7. It hardly matched the Gagarin achievement, but it was a significant start. JFK welcomed our first astronaut to Washington.
I would like to repeat what I said that about Major Gagarin, which was that as a human accomplishment and as a demonstration of courage, I think everyone, whether they're citizens of this country or citizens of another country, take the greatest personal satisfaction in the accomplishment of another member of the human race. As an American, I am, of course, proud of the effort that a great many scientists and engineers and technicians have made, of all of the astronauts, and, of course, particularly of Commander Shepard and his family. We have a long way to go in the field of space. We are behind, but we are working hard, and we are going to increase our effort. In addition, we are making available the scientific information which we have gathered to other scientists in the world community and people who share our view that the probe into space should be peaceful.
I am very, very mindful at this moment of the honor which has been bestowed upon me, an honor which is really one which should go to the hundreds of people who made my flight possible. We have been working approximately 2 years, as you know, because of the press coverage which we've had, on a devoted effort to put a man in space. And it is really to these hundreds of people that the accolades of today should go.
Riding a spacecraft in 1961 was, for Americans, an historical accomplishment. Shepard described a surprise or two.
Quite frankly, there were so many technical things on my mind at that point that I didn't assess any other feelings. I was surprised that the liftoff, that the ignition of the Redstone and the liftoff were as smooth as they were. I really had expected more noise and more vibration. Now, fortunately, we had provided enough padding around the earphones of the helmet, so the noise was not a problem. And the old Redstone itself was smooth enough so that it was a very pleasant liftoff. But when I first looked from the instrument panel, using a gyroscopic indication, down to the periscope itself, I must admit it sort of took my breath away.
July 1961, another suborbital mission. This time, Virgil Gust Grissom was aboard. Alan Shepard spoke to him from Mission Control.
Hey, everything is good. Cabin pressure's holding, seat pressure's okay. 2 minutes, and we got 4 G's. Fuel is go. Feel the hand controller move good to here or there. Cabin pressure's holding. Oxygen is go at 25 amps. Roger, we are go here. Nice to stand by for cutoff.
It was a successful mission in flight. But Grissom's spacecraft, the Libertyville 7, sank shortly after splashdown. A NASA spokesman said of this,
that we are not capsule poor. We would like very much to have gotten this capsule back, primarily to have gotten these onboard camera records and to have a capsule that we could possibly recycle should we want to use it. But we are not capsule poor, and the loss of this capsule will not in any way delay or affect the program.
There were delays, however, as the space program neared full orbital flight, using much more powerful Atlas boosters. John Glenn, the chosen astronaut for that first orbital flight, took those delays and frustrations with Spartan courage. But at long last, in February 1962, Glenn was poised on the threshold of America's first orbit of the Earth.
T-minus 18 seconds and counting engine start.
You have firing signal.
Good Lord, ride all the way.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, we're underway.
This is Friendship 7, a real fireball outside.
Roger, hearing you loud and clear, how you doing?
My condition is good, but that was a real fireball, boy.
As John Glenn hurled through the heavens, the prayers of millions traveled with him. High above Australia, Glenn was surprised and touched to see that the people of Perth had kept their lights burning all through the night to serve as a beacon for Friendship 7. And back in the States, John's mother reflected a nation's pride.
There never has been a moment since John was chosen for Project Mercury that we had any doubts as to his success when he did take the flight, which was today.
I know that I expressed the great happiness and thanksgiving of all of us that Colonel Glenn has completed his trip. And I know that this is particularly felt by Mrs. Glenn and his two children. A few days ago, Colonel Glenn came to the White House and visited me. And he was, as are the other astronauts, the kind of American of whom we are most proud. Some years ago, as a Marine pilot, he raced the sun across this country and lost. And today, he won.
And NASA's Hugh Dryden.
This is a very historic day to which we have been looking forward for a little more than 3 years. When the mission performed so excellently today was only an idea in the mind of a few people like Bob Gilruth and some of his associates. We've come a long way in the 3 years, and all I wanted to say is that this is just the beginning, just the first step. Today, of course, is particularly John Glenn's day, but it is the beginning of an enterprise, the exploration of space that will go for a long time, and not too many years from now, you'll look back at the Mercury capsule as you do on the Wright airplane, and you'll think that this mission, which you've seen today, was a very primitive kind of space mission.
Until John Glenn's flight, NASA had relied on monkeys to supply its scientists with medical data. Before a joint session of Congress, Colonel Glenn revealed that at least one little girl was not too impressed by his achievement.
I think after all of our talk about space, though, this morning coming up from Florida on the plane with President Kennedy, we had the opportunity to meet Mrs. Kennedy and Caroline before we took off. I think Caroline really cut us down to size and put us back in our proper position, though, when after being introduced, she looked up and said, "Where's the monkey?"
Thus, we began to close the gap. German Titov, Russia's second man in space, met with John Glenn during a trip to Washington.
Я следил внимательно за полетом, много читал, так сказать, о полете полковника Глена, но сами понимаете, что увидеть человека было намного приятнее.
I watched the flight of Colonel Glenn, and I read about the flight quite a lot, but you understand that it's much better to see the person personally.
During that visit to the United States, Titov addressed the United Nations. In simultaneous translation, he suggested that Russia and the U.S. might coordinate their efforts in space.
For all, at the present time, one person can't even fly an airplane by himself, and what even less can one single individual conquer outer space. There are enormous complexities involved, and consequently enormous numbers of people, large numbers of countries have to participate in this. And as we do this, we will achieve even greater successes.
Scott Carpenter followed John Glenn into Earth orbit. The flight was routine, but the splashdown was a cliffhanger. Here's Shorty Powers in Mercury Control.
We are still attempting to reestablish contact with the Aurora 7 spacecraft. We expect to establish contact momentarily. This is Mercury Control standing by. Our data at this time indicates that it is distinctly possible that the Aurora 7 spacecraft may land considerably longer downrange than it was planned. Our present estimate of its landing point may go as far as 200 miles downrange. For that reason, we feel that his ionization period now is over, but he has exceeded the range of our transmission equipment here at Cape Canaveral. We are diverting aircraft into the area, both for the purpose of reestablishing communications and effecting a rescue operation.
We got Scott Carpenter and his capsule back home safely, and JFK repeated his administration's pledge.
The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time. And no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. And this generation does not intend that the founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it.
Wally Schirra's solo flight aboard Sigma 7 was without major incident. He returned to his New Jersey home as a conquering hero, but Schirra discounted his personal contribution.
To me, we had perfect flights from Al Shepard, from Gus Grissom, from John Glenn and Scott Carpenter. Each helped to dispel the aura of mystery about space flight. When we came to my flight, we had used all of their experiences, put them into one pocket, took them out one piece at a time, and these little pieces came together, and we called it Sigma.
Gordon Cooper rode aboard Faith 7.
Standing by to start the knockoff flap. Roger. 3, 2, 1, mark. Roger, and the backup clock is running.
Roger, you look good here, Gordo.
Roger, feels good, buddy.
Good sport.
30 seconds and fuel is go. Oxygen is go. Cabin pressure on the top. Clearing out. Filter is working.
Roger, you're looking beautiful.
We're delighted to honor today the most recent of this very exclusive group, Major Cooper, who went furthest in space and did so on the anniversary of Charles Lindbergh's flight to Paris. Charles Lindbergh took approximately the same time to go about 1/150th of the distance of Major Cooper. Both flights were equally hazardous. Both were equally daring. I think one of the things which warmed us the most during this flight was the realization that however extraordinary computers may be, that we are still ahead of them, and that man is still the most extraordinary computer of all. His judgment, his nerve, and the lessons he can learn from experience still make him unique, and therefore make man flight necessary, and not merely that of satellites.
Faith 7 was no misnomer. Here's Gordo Cooper before the Congress.
I'm not too much of a preacher, but while on the flight on the 17th orbit, I felt so inclined to put a small prayer onto the tape recorder of the spacecraft. It was over the middle of the Indian Ocean in the middle of the night. Things had been going so beautifully. Everything had been working correctly. And it was an ideal flight. Father, thank you especially for letting me fly this flight. Thank you for the privilege of being able to be in this possession, to be in this wondrous place, seeing all these many startling, wonderful things that you have created. Help guide and direct all of us that we may shape our lives to be much better Christians, trying to help one another and to work with one another rather than fighting and bickering.
Gordon Cooper's Faith 7 ended the Mercury program, but Russia remained ahead.
At 8:30 Greenwich Mean Time, during the second circuit of the Voskhod 2, the second pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Alexei Leonov, left the spaceship. He was wearing a...
Alexei Leonov had become the first man to walk in space. Our first space twins, Virgil Grissom and John Young, were to fly aboard the Gemini 3. They took note of Russia's space achievements. Gus and Young discussed it.
You can't take it away from the Soviet performance.
All right. Certainly envy the large spacecraft they have, their ability to get out and... They sure have a tremendous TV system. It's a fabulous picture they put out.
I think we're pretty proud of the hardware we have.
Well, we're mighty proud of quite a few things we're doing in space. We're proud of the manned flight and all that has been accomplished the last 48 hours. We're also not taking a backward position in television, as you know yesterday from the Ranger pictures. You got the Tyros for weather, and we use the SYNCOM 2 for communication. And SYNCOM 3 during this flight, we certainly think, as we indicated 48 hours ago, that the Russian people should be proud of their program. But we're mighty proud of our program, and we're not going to take a backseat to anybody.
We fought back. On Gemini 4, NASA's Paul Haney announced.
McDivitt confirms that White did leave the spacecraft. He says it looks great. He's outside working his maneuvering unit. And Jim is quite exuberant about the performance that he's witnessing at this time. Let's cut in live now and listen to what White said. We've not heard him say anything over his comm.
I reach you now, Ed.
Tune in on that conversation.
Okay, I'm out.
Okay, he's out.
I'm rolling to the right now. Under my own influence.
It looks beautiful.
I feel like $1 million. This is the greatest experience. It's just tremendous.
See what the flight director's got to say.
The flight director says get back in.
This is Jim. What, got any message for us?
Jimmy Poole, get back in.
Weeks later, Ed White played down his great achievement.
I feel I'm just a small part of a very big organization. We start with our manned spacecraft center. Then we progress into the tremendous industry that created our booster and our rocket. And then we progress right into the plain man on the street, because let's face it, he's the man who supports our program. And without his go, we don't go either.
Gemini 5 was a rendezvous mission, but problems in the fuel system prevented total success. Still, the astronauts, Cooper and Pete Conrad, kept their cool and their sense of humor.
You got your go for 47-1, right?
Roger.
Okay. You sure do talk a lot.
Say again?
I said you sure do talk a lot.
What'd I say?
Shifting antennas.
You want me to do your song?
Think you can?
She sings off key. Over the ocean, over the blue, here's 75 singing to you.
Oh my God, back to talking.
By now, Russia had launched a three-man crew into Earth orbit. We remained behind, and in late 1965, there were still those who began to question the wisdom of waging active competition with the Soviets. John Glenn, surprisingly, was one of them.
We have still think that probably our program, with no undue setbacks, can land a man on the moon and bring him back by 1970. Now, what the Russian program consists of, I don't know, but I think the space race aspect of this thing, to me, has been overdone.
Midway through the Gemini program, we encountered problems that forced delays in our efforts to rendezvous and dock Earth-circling spacecraft. After several such delays, NASA announced it would put two manned spacecraft in orbit for a rendezvous attempt. Wally Schirra and Tom Stafford would be aboard Gemini 6, Frank Borman and James Lovell aboard Gemini 7. Schirra said of this difficult mission,
We as a crew naturally were prepared for rendezvous sometime on the 25th of October and had no real prediction on when we would accomplish rendezvous until this plan was dusted off and brought to the attention of the appropriate people in management. And then, of course, when we were drawn into the loop for our comments, we immediately responded with great elation. So we didn't even get near the term so-called despondent. We were disappointed when we left the Cape and elated by the time we were in Houston about 4 hours.
Gemini 6 and 7 accomplished their rendezvous mission with flying colors. It was just before Christmas, 1965, and Paul Haney told the world the astronauts had a little present for all of us.
For nearly 2 weeks now, we've been beaming daily music up to our pilots, 2 for most of the time, 4 for the last 24 hours. This morning, the pilots got their revenge. Listen carefully now to the early part of the stateside pass when the Gemini 6 crew reversed the process.
Gemini 7, this is Gemini 6. We have an object, looks like a satellite, going from north to south, probably in a polar orbit. He's in a very low trajectory, traveling from north to south. It has a very high fineness ratio. Looks like it might even be a bottle of stench. It's very low. Looks like maybe going to 300%. Stand by one. Looks like he's trying to signal him.
Six.